Exposition de divertissement électronique. And welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars.
This is one of the only ones I ever get a chance of doing. What is exposition? Something electronic. What was the other one?
Divertissement.
Divertissement. Diversity of electronic. Is this an E3 reference?
More like entertainment. Yes.
Entertainment. Is this an electronic triple reference?
Yes, that's French for electronic entertainment exposition in honor of the video game holiday this week that has claimed one Rob Zachney.
Yes.
And threatened to take our beloved Danny O'Dwyer away, but
I chose. Let it be known, I chose Shift F1 over Giant Bomb. That's what I did. That's why I'm not on the Nintendo press conference feed this morning.
We know where your loyalties lie, Denny. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me, that's Denny O'Dwyer. How are you, Denny? How has this week been going?
Good, yeah. It's been busy. For those who don't care about video games, it's basically just a big weekend where usually we all go to Los Angeles and there's all the video game news. Obviously, we're not in Los Angeles. Although today, they did lift a lot of the restrictions in California. The mandatory mask stuff is all gone. They're doing all that stuff. But it's obviously all digital this year, such is the world. But so it's been fun. It's been fun, especially because my kid was sick yesterday, so I got to play dad during E3, which doesn't often happen. I'm usually pretty enraptured at work, so that was quite pleasant.
I still remember our, it was all TEF 1 at the time, where you and I recorded. We sat in a corner on the E3 show floor, the quietest corner we could find,
yeah,
with a couple of handheld stick mics, and did an episode of Alt F1.
On the stairs of like a bath, outside a bathroom. It wasn't very nice. And also, I had a lot of people actually reaching out saying, like, it's probably a good thing there's no race this weekend, because it always was really difficult to watch the F1 around E3. You know, we were pretty busy. But what would have been last week? I guess it would have been Canada.
It would have been Canada.
Yeah, but we have a triple header coming up.
We do. We filled in one of the slots with a second Austria. But before that, we're kicking off with France. If you are new to this podcast, a very warm welcome. And if you're new to F1 itself, we've got an episode that takes you from zero to 205 or so, and explains how the sport works and who everybody is. So if you'd like to go back and listen to that, it assumes no prior F1 knowledge. That's episode 137. Also, this show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for our patrons that cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you would like to support the show and get access to all of that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. What's going on this month, Danny?
We will have our patron exclusive podcast up later this month. It is on the Monaco. Which year is it? 1955. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Yes. Monaco. Monaco.
Le Mans.
Le Mans. God. Le Mans. Way off on this one. Le Mans 1955, which is an animation which is available wholly on YouTube. So we'll be linking that as well in the show notes. But if you're a media pass holder, of course, you'll have your Paul Ricard track walk. I have actually been practicing this for about 2 weeks because it's the track I know the least. I've gotten pretty good at I can do it pretty good at this stage. Although I must say there was a couple of times, and we'll talk about it later today, where I did take the wrong turn at turn 7 because there's just so many turns in that part of the track that they're not using.
So many turns on this track.
Another interesting development, though, is my P.O. box last night got a delivery from one Circuit Demon. One of our many Media Pass patrons, title sponsor patrons. And I was talking to them a couple of months ago about the fact that I think he managed to secure some of that wine, some of the Daniel Ricciardo.
What?
Wine. Yes, the Australian. Remember he did that? Like special.
Danny, COVID restrictions are lowered now.
Yes,
you can invite me over to drink some Danny Rick wine.
So that's what I have to go check it. And if the box isn't like, you know, wet and red, and it all arrived, I think we'll do that. I think we'll do. I know the media passes where we put all the video, but I think we'll do that for all patrons. as a gift from Mr. Circuit Demon. So let me follow up on that.
Okay.
Let me secure some Australian wine, I guess. continue our a tradition of tasting every beverage that Daniel Ricciardo creates. Because, of course, if you become a patron now, you can check out our taste test of Daniel Ricciardo's Blue Coast beer.
And Rich Energy.
And Rich, yes, sorry. Yes.
We just got to get our hands on some Husky chocolate and then we'd be good.
I know. It's so weird. They sponsor everything. I was watching Indy over the weekend and it was like, man, how do they? They sponsor entire cars over there. I also did see Rich Energy. What was I watching? I was watching some sport last week and Rich Energy was plastered all over it. And I forget what sport it was. It might have been like a lower division MMA thing or something. It was everywhere. I couldn't. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
There's a Rich Energy book coming out, by the way, by Alanis King. Yes, Alanis King and Elizabeth Blackstock.
Oh,
Jalopnik and the Drive automotive reporters are writing a Rich Energy book. I am very excited.
That's interesting. I thought it was going to be written by them, so I'm kind of
by Rich Energy. No. Okay. This is these are professionals. I hope those two can get to the bottom of just what that is.
Speaking of outrageous sponsorships, thank you to all of ours. Jason Kelly, Will Romf, Umberto Roca, Circuit Demon, especially with the wine, Reagan, Sam G, Connor McManus, Jason Chadwick, Abdullah Althani, Bailey Foot, Jack Ben, Greg Salt, Fudo Highs, BPM, who have gone with Blown Pirelli Massacre this week.
Oh, no.
It's pretty good. Drew Stewart, Tracy Syntax, Mr. Mihoff from last week, and our newest member with quite the F1 name, Mr. Simon Villeneuve.
Oh.
Yeah.
There's a Villeneuve coming up in the news.
Oh, there is.
As a matter of fact. Oh, yes.
Villeneuve for days.
Speaking of news, let's get to that before we hit France. Not a lot happening, not a lot of moving and shaking in the F1 world this week, but that gives us a chance, I think, to go a little deeper on some news stories that I wanted to call out here. The first one, kind of on the back of Baku that we were talking about last week. If you recall, Stroll and Verstappen had very similar crashes in that race when their tires exploded. And Stroll's crash earned a safety car, but Verstappen's got a red flag. Some people wanted to know why, and so they asked race director Michael Massey, and he said regarding Verstappen's crash, quote, this is from racefans.net, "We weren't confident that the recovery on the pit straight and the amount of debris that was everywhere could be cleaned up in the appropriate time. So I thought it was in the best interests of the sport to suspend and then restart in that circumstance."
Yeah.
Which I think is a little weird. In my mind, it should be unambiguous when a safety car versus a red flag is called in the rules, since they are with safety in mind, not sport. You know what I mean?
Totally. We are used to all decisions almost being made from a purely safety perspective, right? The idea that there's any element of this which is about the show doesn't really come into our minds, I think, as viewers of the sport, especially the way in which penalties and like everything is always safety related, right? It's, you know, endangering other drivers, endangering yourself, endangering other, you know, people who are recovering vehicles, whatever it is. I remember at the time thinking, oh, they've done a red flag because if they did a safety car, the race is over. And that's
right. And so,
bummer.
Yeah. And I guess it makes sense. Or, you know, without that sporting pressure during Stroll's crash, maybe it makes sense that it was a safety car, not a red flag, because people could just, you know, drive by. There was enough space. And so maybe Verstappen's in this case should have been a safety car. But it wasn't, because Massey acted in the best interests of the show. Now, I'm not complaining about the red flag. A standing restart is way more exciting than ending under safety car. But there are strategy considerations to consider, too. If you recall, Hamilton was leading the race after Verstappen crashed, and thus would have won if it had ended under safety car. So
was Perez not ahead? I thought Hamilton was in second.
He was second behind Verstappen, because Perez, I think, was... Oh, I think you're right.
Mm.
Yeah. But
so I think Perez was ahead, because I remember thinking, oh, at least Perez will have won, which will be cool.
Right, and I think this is why Red Bull was lobbying Massey to do a red flag, so that he could come in and change his tires to new ones to defend from Hamilton.
And Hamilton also got to change his front wing, which was, you know, interesting.
Right, but you can envision... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but you're allowed to do that type of stuff during a red flag. They're allowed to touch the car, as it were. It's not in park fermé.
Right, but you could see if, you know, say, you could see a team not wanting the red flag to happen because it bunches the field back up again and allows cars behind them to do things like change tires.
Totally.
I think Gasly
was probably in that scenario, because he was kind of... He was waiting to be eaten up, or anyone who had a gap, and there were plenty of gaps, because it's a fairly long circuit, as we talked about beforehand. So you do tend to get, you know, there's less blue flag shenanigans happening, or less often, I guess. So I'm sure there were people that, didn't want to get bunched up that way. Also, you know, it's not, you know, calling a safety car, calling a red flag in and of itself isn't more or less dangerous, but if the repercussion is that under a safety car, you know, they're probably not finishing the race, because it's like there's only three or four laps when the crash happened, right? It took them a while to get the red flag out. Whereas, a standing start with everyone bunched up with no time to overtake is about as much of a dead-on situation for there to be contact between cars as you can basically imagine. So, you're right. The decision not only... It's not like this was an inert decision. This decision actually does create the opportunity for more crashes. So...
Right.
That's maybe why it sits a little funny on the stomach.
Yeah, I think my main concern, though, is that it is ambiguous at this point. It's completely at the... Ideally, this would be a computer making this decision, right? which I think is kind of the opinion of one Jacques Villeneuve.
Oh, yes.
Who, if you don't know, is a pretty outspoken Canadian former F1 driver who won the championship in 1997. And he is quoted in this Race Fans article saying, quote, about this, "Ultimately, with the restart at the end, there's an issue with that red flag because it's random. Teams will complain that, oh, you helped that team that one time, but not us the other time. So I think there has to be a fixed rule. If you want to give a red flag at the end of the race, then it should be in the rules that if it's under caution with three laps to go, there will be a red flag. So it's not one race yes, one race no. That way it's always the same and there's no bickering afterwards." What do you think of that?
I mean, I don't not agree with him. The issue, the only... it's very weird, because we definitely have a lot of understanding F1 and sort of following along with the ethos of F1 is to be very engaged with your pragmatic brain, with the idea that things are orderly and that we understand things, because there's a lot of different complex systems happening at one time. It's like if F1 was a, I guess F1 is a video game, but like if F1 as a system which you're interacting with is really complicated, and it's only through finding patterns, like the way humans understand complicated things is that we sort of break things down into really easy to understand patterns. And that's what the experience I think of watching F1 is that you have sort of shorthand in your hand for, oh, if this happens, then that happens, because actually what's going on is really complicated. So I think you're right. When things like this happen, the immediate sort of reaction is, well, I don't like that, because that's really ambiguous, and that's human. You know, that's coming from a different place, or that's something that I can't anticipate. And from a strategy perspective, obviously it's completely, you know, you can't, if you don't know what a conclusion is, if you don't know what, you know, causation is going to be created by an instance, then you can't strategize against it, especially if the two strategies are going to be so different, right? A safety car, mm-hmm. or the race ending, or we're going to go again for two laps. It's like impossible to plan, right? Either or. So I don't disagree on a fundamental pragmatic level. However, was the best part of the race the final two laps? Yes. Would end is ending a race under safety car the most boring thing that ever happens in F1? Absolutely. You know, what are we doing here? We're here to be entertained. We're here to enjoy people racing. So I'm with you. I think it's, you know, I prefer the latter. I like that he called a red flag. If there had been a horrific crash, for instance, maybe we'd be having a different conversation around this, which I guess is another separate conversation. But I can understand that at least it would be nice to have some clarity over it. But if I'm completely honest, I think we'll totally forget at the end of this race. This instance was kind of rare and probably won't happen again. And I don't see a scenario where they'd pick a red flag over a safety car any other time in a race. So I think this was very much a, it's the last two laps, let's halt everything. So I'm not overly worried about it, but I don't disagree with Jacques Villeneuve. I'm not going to disagree with the, you know, Jacques fucking Villeneuve. He knows more about F1 than I do.
And he knows more about Ultima Online than I do.
Wait, is he a big Ultima Online fan?
Oh, yeah. I think that was the game. Like, he had to, like, get internet into his motorhome while he was driving so that he could play.
Oh, my God. I'm not surprised. He was always, like, a wacky figure. You know, the white hair and...
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he didn't need to be. I mean, his father is F1 royalty, so... Yeah.
Speaking of that, shall we move on to Williams?
Yeah.
Their team principal, a man named Simon Roberts, left the team last week. Normally this would be a bad sign, but I actually think it's the opposite in this case. So I wanted to kind of, dive into this a little bit. F1 has an interview on their website with, I'm going to go with Jost Capito, who has been the CEO at Williams since February. If you recall, they, were recently bought by a, an American investment group or something. I think that's what they are. And I think Simon Roberts was like an interim team principal just to like figure things out. And then, this guy, Jost Capito, came in and, basically, according to this article on F1's website, set about speaking to everyone in the business, holding more than 81-to-1 meetings with senior managers.
Wow.
To find out what was needed to change. And what he found was that the trackside folks and the factory folks weren't talking to each other.
Interesting.
That they reported to different people. And that's sort of a leftover from the fact that Paddy Lowe, who was the chief technical officer for Williams, he had come back to the team in 2017, but he left in 2019, and they never filled his role. So those lines of communication were just going nowhere, apparently.
Seems like maybe they were when he was there, too, based on Drive to Survive, at least.
So kind of combined with this is they had Paddy Lowe on F1's podcast Beyond the Grid recently, which I'll link in the show notes if you want to go listen to it. And he was pretty diplomatic, but he did sort of illuminate a little bit about just what was happening with Williams at the time. He came in 2017 to kind of help halt their downward slide, which began around that time. They were like third, and then they were like fifth, and then 10th.
Nowhere left to slide.
Right. He says in his interview, quote, "I'm good at a lot of things, and I think I've proven that in a number of areas, but I can't work miracles." What he said next, though, I thought was really interesting. He says, "Williams had the benefit of the best engine by a long chalk from 2015. So that gave some, let's say, false impression of underlying performance. They were living off a number of other legacy advantages that gradually unwound. When the organization starts to lose its way because it hasn't had the right investments or made the right decisions, it doesn't instantly make bad cars."
Yeah.
And that the period he's talking about is when they were getting third place in the championship. So this has been a long time coming, according to Paddy Lowe. So instead, you had trackside folks not talking to Patty Lowe, but talking to Roberts, their team principal, who, because he was a management guy, didn't pass along that technical stuff to the factory guys because he was too busy running the team. So long story short, Capito's making a lot of management changes that sound smart, including installing one of his old buddies from his World Rally Championship days. This is where he comes from. I think he also has some McLaren experience, but most recently and most successfully, the Volkswagen World Rally Championship team. One of his friends is now technical director at Williams, and hopefully this means that Williams will be able to get back to a functioning team.
That's I think interesting due diligence to hear somebody doing 81 different interviews, one-on-one interviews. I mean, like I said, the only way is up, so more power to them. That type of structural change is always like super, super, super difficult. So it's interesting that they came in and sort of understood that that was, you know, I guess everyone sort of assumed that that was for the type of change that they probably want, which is a sort of very vast, you know, turnaround happening over years and years, that that's the type of thing that needs to happen. So yeah, more power to them. I think Williams have, you know, even if you're not a Williams fan, I think they have done their time at the bottom of the pack, and people will be very happy to see them even just be competitive at this stage, because they're not even competitive with other teams at the bottom of the track is the problem. So yeah, more power to them.
Speaking of power and IndyCar, you mentioned you watched some this weekend.
Yeah. It was good fun. We had the double header in Detroit, I want to say. I think it was.
If you want to talk about it, I can put spoiler tags at the top of the show.
I won't talk about who won, but there was a... You should definitely check it. If you don't watch IndyCar, I think it's worth even just going to their YouTube channel, and they have like good 10-minute highlight reels.
They have good 30-minute highlight... They have a 5-minute, a 10-minute, and a 30-minute highlight reel of each... race, and the 30-minute ones are actually pretty good because they kind of cut out all the yellows, all the sections of no passing. It's a decent way to watch the show, especially watching it on NBC is just awful because
the commercials
just they completely ruin it. I managed to watch a Sky Sports broadcast IndyCar this weekend, the first race, and boy is that a different experience.
Right, no ads.
They pipe in the NBC commentary when they are doing it, but then when NBC goes to commercial, the video keeps going, but there's no commentary.
Funny.
Half the time, a British guy would come on and do some breakdowns of like what's going on, but the other half, it was just cars going around, and it was great.
That's
so
amazing.
If you're in the UK, congratulations.
Wink, wink. That's funny. I remember the Super Bowl, I think we've talked about this before, has a similar thing in the UK where, you know, the Sky Sports feed, which is already happening, by the way, at like, you know, 2 a.m, you're watching this thing in Ireland or in England or the UK. But because of the amount of commercials that are going on there, they just cut back to a panel. So it's really cool. So that you're constantly getting touch-ups by this panel who, you know, is often has like, you know, one or two ex-NFL players, a bunch of British guys talking about it, which is pretty cool.
Also do cut downs of like, here's the game, but without any timeouts or stoppages between play. So it's just solid football piped into your eyeballs.
Oh my God. I don't think I'll be able to take that. I think I need the breaks. It's like baseball. If they just ran up and hit it and then ran back. Give me my 7th inning stretch. But yeah, it was there was 2 races on, a doubleheader in Detroit. The only spoiler I'll say is that Romain Grosjean ended up in a car that was on fire again, but he was fine. His brakes burst into flames.
I'll see if I can link this video too. But he jumped out of his car very quickly once he realized there was fire happening.
Yes.
Which is kind of, I don't know, maybe feel weird watching him do that. And then immediately like looked around, like put his arms out, like, does anyone have a fire extinguisher? And then some marshals handed one to him through the fence, and he went back over and tried to put out his own car, which is like, stand back, everyone. I've got this. I know.
Yeah.
Been here before.
It's his fucking nemesis. Fire turned up again. It's his arch nemesis. He has to destroy it. It felt like something out of a Talladega Nights sort of skit, you know, where it's like,
right.
You know, it's not quite Ricky Bobby rolling around on the ground, but it was, you know, sort of like, I will do this, because they literally had to peel him away because the
safety team showed up and we're like, we got this, it's okay. And he tried to fight him a little bit, like, no, I can put it out.
Like, where, why didn't you guys here earlier, kind of?
I mean, they got there like 10 seconds.
I know, yeah. But like 10 seconds to him, you know, you saw how long I was in Drive to Survive, right? It was 20 minutes he was in that fire, it felt like.
That's so true, yeah.
Probably felt like at least 3 minutes
this
time. But yeah, thankfully, not to make light of it, Roman is totally fine. In fact, he's feeling so safe in safety car that according to racer.com, he's going to tackle an oval, it looks like. If you've been listening to this podcast, you know that Grosjean, you know, in a fairly serious crash in his last F1 race, he went to IndyCar, a sport that he kind of didn't really follow until his final year in F1, probably, you know, reading the tea leaves and keeping his options open. But the sort of one caveat of him, between him and his family, of him doing this, was that he wouldn't do ovals, because ovals are super fast, you know, pedal to the metal. It's a different type of driving, but the types of crashes you obviously get into in ovals are even more serious than the crashes you get in Indy. In fact, did you see that one crash in Indy that where the throttle stuck?
Yes.
I forget who it was. It was Marcus Ericsson, was it?
No, it was Felix Rosenquist.
Oh, it was Felix Rosenquist. Okay, sorry. Yeah, he was taking a sharp, his pedal just went down. It was like, hit the rev limiter. It was like very scary looking.
Yeah, and they said after, like, I read a news story about it. They said like it wasn't a it wasn't driver error. And the throttle didn't get. They said the throttle didn't get stuck, but that
the throttle
was stuck open.
Like, yeah, I remember what they said.
They said like some mechanical thing.
This felt like it was written by an insurance assessor or something to make sure culpability wasn't in the wrong place. But yeah, they said it definitely wasn't his fault. They said it wasn't the fault of the systems of the car. I forget which car he drives in, but it wasn't a fault of whatever thing it was. They said it was a one-time mechanical error. So I guess what they're saying is that it wasn't part of the... It was a one-off of the chassis that they're all operating off of, not something that they did themselves or the driver.
Weird.
But that it was a one-time thing and that they are fairly confident it's non-repeatable, or they fixed the thing to make it non-repeatable or something. Scary, scary crash. Red flag, the whole thing. He didn't get out of the car either. They had to bring him to the hospital. So, anyway, sorry.
He's okay,
here,
though.
So, yeah, thankfully, he's okay. And also, Grosjean is too, and he's confident enough to do some ovals. This from racer.com. As part of the 34-year-old's future planning, he's added a last oval of the season at Worldwide Technology Raceway, formerly known as Gateway, to an original calendar compromised exclusively of road and street courses. There's a quote here from Grosjean about him deciding to do ovals. He says, Gateway has been on my radar for some time, so I decided to race there after St. Pete. I talked with Dale. He's just talking with Dale. And I think it's what I would like to do. A lot of the guys are saying that it's really good racing, so I want to get a taste for it to see where it goes. It's a good one for me to start. It's a short track, just less fast, and has a bit more braking and accelerating, which I feel confident with to start. I will do some simulator work at Honda, that's for sure. Also, I will have a test day that's mandatory for me as I'm a rookie and to go do a test. And he seems to really be enjoying IndyCar. I mean, it comes across in the races. Like, he's taking it seriously. He's done well. You know what I mean? Like, he's gotten results as well most recently. Detroit, maybe not so great for him. But, you know, he's still learning. He's still a rookie, as he said. He said, I'm being super happy in the US racing IndyCar. It's a series that I love and I feel good in it. So, yeah, I see myself here for a bit of time. But obviously, everything needs to come together. There's great opportunities. And, yeah, let's see how it goes. He is good at Indy. I think this does suit him very well. You know, it's been fun watching Indy he has been my gateway into watching Indy properly this year. I think I've always dabbled, but this year I've been watching every race, and keeping up on him and some of the other F1 alumni has been a lot of fun, and I'm really happy for him to take the, you know, take a swing at the ovals. It's a different skill for sure, so I'm not sure if he'll get many points on ovals, but, you know, he's in the mix. He could easily, you know, with the right string of results, and if he was doing ovals, he could break into the top five, top 10 for sure. So I think this is good for him. Baby steps.
Indeed. Speaking of other people in new cars.
Yeah, Sergio. This has been an interesting news article. I didn't know about this. I know Alexander Albon was doing some stuff on the back end at Red Bull, but I didn't quite understand how integral he is to that team. And he got a shout out from Sergio Perez. Good guy Albon getting a shout out from good guy Sergio. This from autosport.com. Perez impressed by Albon's openness since taking his Red Bull seat. I think we got a pretty good team, Perez said. I think what Max did was great to see. He really deserved the win. He did everything perfect that weekend, him referring to Baku, of course. He was just very unlucky. It really was his win. And Alex as well. He's putting so much work into the simulator with the engineers. I remember when I came here, you wouldn't expect from him to be so open in that way with me, but he explained to me all the issues he had, how the car works, and that was very nice since day one to have from him. I really appreciate that, and I appreciate the work he's putting in weekend after weekend with the team in the simulator. This is teamwork, and ultimately we are here thanks to every single individual in this team. Finally, from Autosport, Albon has remained a key part of the Red Bull F1 setup despite his demotion, with his work on the simulator also being highlighted by team principal Christian Horner as a key factor in helping Verstappen's win in Monaco last month. In fact, there was a really good video on the F1 YouTube channel a couple of days ago which goes into specifically at McLaren, but it details the work that sim drivers do, or, you know, test drivers do on the simulator, which of course is not just something that happens, you know, on off weekends or before the season or during breaks. It's happening during practice. They are doing like for like laps in the simulator, trying to create technical parity, and then changing stuff on the setup. They're trying to like basically create parity with real life, fine tuning it, changing stuff so that like in the next practice session they can try that or tweak this for qualifying. And there's a really good video. Yeah, it's about 8 minutes long on the YouTube channel, which dives into some of that with McLaren. So cool. Absolutely worth checking out.
Sweet. Speaking of McLaren, couple little quick hits here. They are entering Extreme E.
Extreme.
In 2022. They've been doing pretty well with their team in IndyCar, so I guess they thought Zach Brown was like, let's do even more. Extreme E is, of course, the off-road electric racing series that debuted this year. Yeah, I think they just had their second round. It's cool. It's weird, but I caught a lot of it this last weekend. I caught up on it, and it's one of those, if you're not missing a whole lot by watching the highlights. There's a lot of kind of downtime. There's a lot of like cars very apart from each other. So highlights are a decent way to watch it. I can link that in the show notes as well.
A good mix of, because the way they race as well, it's a lot of like tandem racing and 1v1 racing. And also the tracks are kind of, you know, non-existent.
They're not tracks. They're just racing out in the wilds. Unfortunately though, for Extreme E, they have called off their last two events of only five events this year due to COVID, Brazil and Argentina. But they say that the series is considering alternative race locations, so hopefully that continues to be a healthy series. And then one final thing here, speaking of, the guy who started Formula E,
yes,
Alejandro Agag,
the man
also started Extreme E. Uh-oh. And Uh-oh. Is starting a new one that we have talked about, I think, a little bit before.
Is this the boat one?
The E1 series.
Okay.
So loves that letter. And there are some new renders of what the boats are going to look like, look rad.
Show me these boats. Whoa.
They look the most like Wipeout machines.
Oh, yeah. That is Wipeout. That is absolutely... That should have Pfizer written on the side of it.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
I will link
race,
that.
The race bird, they're referring to it as. The race bird. Look at that. Oh, my God. Also, just these are obviously CG renders, but they did put the time to put water droplets on some of the car, which I really appreciate.
The car.
Sorry, the boat. It looks like a car. Look at it. Look at that thing. That's wild. Man, that is something else.
Do you think they'll call them boats? Or do you think they'll call them something like craft?
Yeah. What's race bird? Is that just a concept name? They're not just going to call them race birds every week? I'm not sure that would stick. Stop trying to make race bird happen, Mr. Agag. Yeah,
I mean, they are hydrofoils, so they will be kind of flying.
Yeah, I don't think that's a boat. I don't think it's a boat unless you can, you know, sit on the deck.
Don't they call them machines in is it F-Zero or Wipeout?
Wipeout. I don't know what they call them.
Video game racing series calls them machines.
I bet. I don't remember that from Wipeout, so maybe that's an F-Zero thing. Yeah, it's not. Like, where do we... What is... I feel like you understand a lot of the Navy stuff. You've done your research on Navy stuff. You've covered it. Where is... Because obviously, like, we're saying, you know, U-boats and submarines are not... They're not boats, although they are called U-boats, so maybe...
They're not a ship, they are a boat.
Okay, so a boat is if you're in the water, but
if you're a submarine, you're a boat.
That's a boat, okay. So these are boats, then?
I guess. They're not ships.
But they're not ships.
Craft sounds cool.
They look rad. I mean, they don't look that different to... It looks like a very cool version of a very fast speedboat. Like those crazy ones you see them...
Cigarette boats.
Yeah. Oh, looks cool. Man, what's he going to do next? He's running out of... It's going to be space or... Like, I don't know. Where does that guy go from here?
Electric plane racing. Diddy Kong racing. Let's do it.
Yeah, that's good. I like that.
Put them all together.
Solar. Let's make it happen. Solar planes. We'll fly above the clouds. Shoot them above the clouds. Or just fly in places where there's no clouds.
Speaking of cigarettes, Danny. Let's go.
Excuse me.
To France.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's fair. Yes, the south of France. Finally, the south of France, the Riviera, has a race. Because we've all decided that Monaco is not a real race. It's kind of like a traffic jam. An expensive traffic jam. So finally, we're going to... Okay, I just want to preface this. We're setting expectations low, folks. Especially welcome to all of you. Every year we get beautiful new listeners who watch Drive to Survive. We're all about it. You can't wait to go to France.
And who may have just watched Baku and gone, this is amazing.
I know, right? F1 can't get any better. Baku was the party. This is the sort of day you sleep in after it. Don't worry about it. Like, we might have some good racing here. You know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah. They did just resurface it, I think.
Yeah. Which is great because the entire racetrack is surfaced because it has more runoff than most tracks have asphalt.
Basically, a parking lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Circuit de Gilles. Not Circuit de Gilles. I'm getting my French. I've got Villeneuve on the mind now. This is all Simon
Ricard.
And Jacques' fault. Sorry. Paul Ricard. Circuit Paul Ricard in the south of France. So this has been part of the F1 calendar over the years. I barely do not remember it. I always remember Manicourt. I don't ever remember this track since before the sort of most recent edition of it. It ran in 1971 for the first time until 83, so it had a pretty decent chunk. And then it also came back between 85 and 90, where I was the ages of -1 to 4. So I don't ever remember this track at all. But it did come back in 2018 as part of this bigger, fatter, chunkier F1 calendar, and also as part of the fairly, you know, beefy European wing of F1, and it has stuck around. It's a weird track because this track is basically like a weekend warrior track and also a pretty popular testing track as well. It's as flat as a pancake. It's at the bottom of a plateau. It has high speed corners, it has medium speed corners, it has low speed corners. It is pretty long as well, so you can fit a lot of people on it, and it also has bunches of configurations, which when you see the helicopter shots of this track, you're going to be like, How do the drivers know where to turn? Obviously, from their perspective, it's maybe a little bit less confusing. But like I said at the top of the show, during my track walks, I have sometimes been taking the wrong turns as a result of this, especially between turn 7 and turn 8. But it's as a result of that, whenever, you know, we watch F1 tracks for the first time, you tend to like remember parts of the track because they look different, or because, oh, this is the part in Baku with the castle, or this is the really long straight, or look, it's Monaco, we're in the tunnel now. There's all those types of things. It's trickier on this one. I have to go back and play this in the game before most races here because it is so similar looking. There's just a lot of runoff, a lot of you know, blue and black sort of painted areas off the track.
The one where if you look like from above, it's almost like all the turns have these like Wi-Fi lines are like radiating out.
Yes.
Those are more like the paint is like attacking material, so they're meant to slow the cars down if they go off. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. There's three different levels of abrasion basically on the asphalt that they use here. So there's obviously the track part, then outside of that there is a you're leaving the track here, love, sort of
like the warning track in baseball.
Yeah, basically. And then the last one is kind of more it gets pretty tacky, it gets pretty sticky and abrasive on the tires. Okay.
It's like gravel you don't have to clean up.
Yeah, basically, there's no gravel here. There's hardly any gravel on this track. You have to go pretty far out to hit any of that stuff. So, yeah, you end up having this sort of like multi-stratted runoff as a result, which means that you get really weird races. I think it was 2019 where it was Vettel hit Bottas, spun him around, and between turns 1 and turn 4, you just had cars go. It was like the start of a Trackmania level. There was just cars going all over the place. Like they were missing the turns and it was just like chaotic. So as a result, yeah, it's a bit of a weird race. I think as boring as this track can be, it's also just not a great viewing experience because it is so samey from the sort of high angles we watch F1 at. But, I am saying all this in hope that I am riling the F1 gods, and I can push. Every track has its day, and I think Ricard one day will provide us a really compelling race. Who knows, maybe it gets super windy here one day and it really throws the whole thing off. But basically all you need to know is that there is one big long straight which they basically stick a sort of, it's not a chicane, but they stick some low speed corners into, or medium speed corners into, in the middle to break the whole thing up. And it's on that straight, both ends of that turn, that you will see the overtakes. There's a big DRS zone between turn 7 and 8, and then turns, I guess, 9 up through 10, which is 10 is basically taken flat out. Half of 11 is taken flat out, actually. You enter it at super speed and lift off and then drop down. It's actually a really fun track to do on a race wheel, just because of the because there's some of these turns of like, you know, you're downshifting over the course of the entire turn slowly. It's really fun. But yeah, that whole back straight is basically where the lion's share of the overtaking is going to happen here. There is a DRS straight on the start finish straight, but it's not particularly long. And the only change they really made was in 2019, they changed the entry to the pit lane, which was on the straight and was kind of awkward. It was as if, imagine the entrance to the pit lane in Australia. Where it is now is where it is in Paul Ricard. Where it was before was after the first turn. Or the last turn. So you'd get onto the straight and then have to enter the pit. But that was super dangerous because if somebody was undertaking you on the inside of the last turn, it was causing problems. So just like Melbourne, they basically put it between the penultimate and last turn in 2019. But that's been the only change. It is what it is. You can go race there yourself if you want.
Yeah, and I did see, again, that they're resurfacing it, but they may have done small changes to some of the camber on the corners, I heard. But that, you know, also resurfacing it means that it's very smooth now and won't cause as many mistakes as a result. So who knows?
The corners there are pretty forgiving because, at least, I'm not sure about if they've added... you know, deterrence, basically, right? Like that's something to put the sleeping policeman down, stuff like that. But again, because it is a sort of a track that you can drive on your car. You know what I mean? Like, there's more general punters on it. They tend not to put big curbs on those tracks because people fuck their cars up. You know, imagine like an F1 car is one thing hitting a curb. Imagine driving your, like, you know, your Miata over a curb that's 4 inches off the ground. You know, things gonna fall apart. Yeah, so we'll see. We'll have to see.
Well, we'll see some balmy weather, low 80s on qualifying day, or high 20s if you're Celsius. Very low chance of precipitation on qualifying day. We're looking at 7% here. Wind, though, looks like 12 miles an hour, or 19 kilometers an hour. So it's not nothing. About the same in terms of wind on race day and temperature, but precipitation will climb to 25%. So fingers crossed for something to happen.
Yeah, we'll have to see there. Yeah. The other thing I just thought of was the track limits argument we've had going back to Bahrain. This is track limits central. I mean, I know they did the stuff off the line, but they've changed the runoff, but we'll have to see. This might be the one that really starts that conversation up again.
Yeah. Well, going into this race, let's run down the standings here. Max Verstappen is on top of the Drivers' Championship for the first time in his career with 105 points. Lewis Hamilton, though, is close behind with 101. Then we've got Sergio Perez with 69. Lando Norris has 66. And Charles Leclerc has 52 in fifth place. Valtteri Bottas is in sixth with 47, followed by Sainz with 42, Gasly with 31, Vettel with 28, and in 10th place is Ricciardo with 26. Then we jump a little bit down to 11th place with Fernando Alonso with 13, Esteban Ocon, his teammate, with 12, Lance Stroll has 9, Tsunoda has 8, Kimi Raikkonen and Antonio Giovinazzi tied for 15th with 1 point, and then Schumacher, Russell, Mazepin, and Latifi all have 0. In constructor standings, Red Bull is on top with 174, followed by Mercedes with 148. Ferrari is in third place with 94. McLaren is in fourth with 92. In fifth place is AlphaTauri with 39. And then Aston Martin with 37. Alpine is in seventh place with 25. Alfa Romeo has 2. And Jean Haas and team and Williams both have 0 points. And that's the standings. You can also join our fantasy league if you like by clicking the link in the show notes if you yourself want to try to be in some standings. Should we take it to some emails?
Let's do it. shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or f1.cool/emails. I'll take this first one from Janus. This weekend, unfortunately, saw the collapse of the young Danish soccer player Christian Eriksen during the match against Finland. I was young. He is young. I think he's 29. Not particularly young for football standards, it must be said. But did you see this, Drew?
I saw the news stories, yeah.
Yeah, during the Euros. Shocking stuff. Going back to the email, luckily he is said to be okay, but obviously it left all the viewers as well as the players in a bit of shock. The game was later restarted, which made a lot of people angry. It made me think of the attitude in Formula One, where races are always restarted, as far as I know, and the fans are okay with that. But in the instances where F1 accidents have fatal outcomes, does the race still continue? I can't remember. Obviously, crashes are part of the sport, and every single driver knows that. So what do you think would happen if a driver had a heart attack, like in the above situation? I would love to hear your thoughts, Janus. Or I guess if there was a fatality, which unfortunately we have plenty of use cases to pull from. So I think in the instance of Christian Eriksen, because he was resuscitated on the pitch, and this is unfortunately not new to football either. There was Fabrice Muamba collapsed during a Premier League game years and years ago, and they were resuscitating on the pitch for like 30 minutes, I think, before he also recovered, thankfully. But he was stable. Christian Eriksen, at least everyone knew he was back in hospital and stabilized and conscious, pretty soon afterwards. So at least there was that. I think if it wasn't during the Euros also, they would have called it off, but there is added pressure because this is a tournament where they only have certain times blocked out. You know, if you want to fill a stadium or do all that sort of stuff, you have to have local ordinances with police and all that. You know, there's a lot going on. So I think there is no one scenario in any sport where it's cut and dry what you're meant to do. The one that stuck out to mind with this one is, you know, a lot of the times crashes, if they are fatal, sometimes you don't know until after the fact, for instance. You don't know immediately in the moment. Other times you do, like Roland Ratzenberger died. He didn't die on the race day. You know what I mean? Like, he died on the weekend leading up to the San Marino Grand Prix, in which Senna would also end up perishing. So those drivers went to the track knowing that one of their friends had perished beforehand. And I think, to me, that is the one standout in this instance. We did have the tragic death of a MotoGP driver just earlier this year, Jason Dupasquier, I believe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was during the race.
It was Moto 3 during qualifying, yeah.
Sorry, that was during qualifying. They did go ahead with the race. His team didn't. So that was an instance where I also thought, okay, like, you know, does the show need to go on in a Moto 3? I'm not saying less about Moto 3 or anything, but it is a lower, you know, that's a pretty harsh thing for these young, mostly young drivers to be doing, but they did just go ahead with it. And of course, Antoine Hubert, that was during the sprint race, I want to say, the first sprint race at Spa, and they did cancel the second one. So it depends on the instance, you know. This is a pretty morbid question, but it is something that has come up quite a lot in the emails over the past week, so I wanted to cover it off. But yeah, I think, you know, there is no one-size-fits-all approach to this type of, you know, tragedy. I'm very grateful to see Christian Eriksen getting up after that. That was some pretty shocking stuff. I think the director for that game actually should probably not get another go of that, because they were showing a lot more of that instance on television than they really needed to. But yeah, in terms of racing, I think oftentimes there is pause to not race, but yeah, there is that mentality, right? We saw it with Grosjean last year, where, you know, once they saw him get out of the car and walking, it was like, all right, we're getting back in our cars.
Yeah, and a lot of times you don't know, you know, in cases like this, they're sent to a hospital, so you don't really know. And then the show goes on, and then it's only afterwards that you learn, you know, that maybe it'd be weird to continue. But yeah, I think also, you know, I'm not a racer, but this is the thing that, you know, that racer loved doing. And so you hear this sometimes when you talk to drivers that have to go on after this. They say, like, you know, this is what they would have wanted, and of course it's impossible to really know that, but it's a strange fraternity that they are all in. So yeah, it's certainly a weird aspect.
The strangest one, I think I remember, the most sickening one, was when Dan Weldon passed away in 2011, because that was during the race, but they announced it over the tannoy at Las Vegas Motor Speedway, I believe, which was bizarre and just horrible and morbid. And then I believe they continued the race, right? Because it got red flagged for that, I think.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, that was. You know, that was a lot. But yeah, these things do tend to happen all over the weekend. And yeah, the Ratzenberger one is always the one that stuck out to me a bit. Drew, do you want to take this next one? Sorry, I think I've forgotten to put whose name was in it. Let me search that while you're reading it.
Okay. This email says, "Hey guys, I'm getting a bit fed up at some of the backlash against Yuki following his outburst at Baku, where he told his engineer to shut up. I understand it's not the most diplomatic way to talk to an engineer, but he's speaking a second language at 200 miles per hour as a rookie. To me, it seems like a huge double standard. When the lovable Kimi has an outburst, the community as a whole has a good laugh. While Yuki's outbursts are more frequent, there seems to be racial undertones at play in the backlash against Yuki, and that's been bothering me. I'm curious what your take is on his outbursts, as well as if you perceive the same racial/cultural issues against Yuki that I do." I think, first of all, we've talked about this a little bit, where I have felt, as a rookie, he gets a lot of this weird feeling that he should, he should be thankful that he's in Formula One and thus shouldn't cause any, you know, ruffle any feathers.
Right. Be quiet. Yeah. Yeah,
which is odd because I think you do. I'm trying to remember when Verstappen came in. He sort of earned a reputation, at least from my viewing, as like a guy who wasn't, even though he was new, he wasn't going to take anything from anybody, you know. Got his elbows out pretty quick and was shoving around world champions, you know, just they couldn't bully him basically. And I think you have to do that in a such a cutthroat business like this. And so I don't agree with that sort of sentiment. Obviously the Rachel thing, is of course hard to pin down, but I don't think you can discount it.
Yeah.
And his age as well. And his physical stature, I think may all contribute to this sort of,
like perception or assumption or something. I'm with you. It feels like it's not one thing, but that's certainly in the mix. Especially when I think about Asian sports stars in like white sports as we watch here in the West, right? White dominated sports and stuff. And you think about other F1 race drivers, and you do have like this, the stereotype of the sort of kooky Asian driver, right? Where you had people like Kimi Kobayashi, for instance, or definitely Take Inoue, who, you know, unfairly perhaps, it doesn't help that Take Inoue was involved in a bunch of bizarre incidents, but then maybe some other non-Asian drivers would be and wouldn't have that associated with them, right? In the same way that, like, I guess Kimi does, but Kimi sort of created that for himself almost, right? A lot of these drivers, I feel like, almost have to reject it, you know, they get it by default or something. I was also, you know, there's a UFC on this weekend with a fantastic UFC fighter who's been in the sport for a long time called Korean Zombie, who is a similar sort of thing around him and like this sort of personality or something. So I do think that he probably stepped into some shoes that weren't his when he came to F1. I don't think there's any getting around the fact that his outbursts are particularly funny. Like, outside of the fact that he is a rookie and outside of the fact that he is, you know, that he is young and outside of the fact that he's Asian, he also does tell people to shut the fuck up, which we don't hear very often on team radio. So
it's true.
So I think Devin is right. I think there is definitely a certain lens that perhaps an unconscious lens that many of us view him through. But also he's coming in with a sort of a don't fuck with me attitude that maybe he has to, in a way, to shake off that perception. Yeah.
I think both things might be happening, right? Like he is a particularly fiery guy on the radio. He's not, if you go listen to the Beyond the Grid episode, he's like
so
a pretty
nice. He's a pretty chill guy. So nice. All of his interviews, he's like the nicest dude. He's like very, so that's what I love. It's like the firebrand. It's his sporting, you know, determination is just unfiltered in the car. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think why it's tough for me to pin down, but why I still feel a little weird is I think it's because the reaction signifies that people were expecting something different.
Yes.
And why was that expectation there? That I think is what kind of rubs me the wrong way.
Yes. The quiet minority, the don't, you know, because like you said, it could be like, oh, he's young and he's a rookie. He should be happy to be in the sport. Do we level that same thing against Mick Schumacher? You know, based on obviously his family.
He is a very diplomatic and nice guy.
But yeah. Or like if we were to swap the on-race actions of, let's say, Nikita Mazepin and Yuki Tsunoda, what would that then present us with? You know, it's worth throwing these ideas around your head, I think, because so much of this stuff is unconscious bias that we, you know, we're not, you know, you don't have to take it personally. It's not that we come into these things being overtly one way or another, but we definitely, there are like things going on as we perceive sports and people that sometimes we're not really aware of. But Yuki's challenging in that way. Like, I liked it. I'm with you. I like that he's loud. I think it's funny and maybe not typical of most drivers coming to the sport, but also, sure, like, you know, like you said, we felt the same way about Verstappen when he came in.
Yeah. Thank you to Devin.
Yes.
For that email.
Thanks for the question. And this last one comes in from Charlie. Hey guys, really enjoyed the pod and felt it was time to send in a question. I was delighted to see Checo on the top step after a thrilling finale in Baku. In fact, it was great to see three drivers who were all thrown out / moved on from previous teams filling the podium. Yeah, it's kind of like an island of misfit toys up there. I was scrolling through Instagram today and saw a video posted on Red Bull's profile of Perez handing his winner's trophy back to Red Bull HQ. I was shocked by this, and it made me think, is it common practice for drivers to give their trophies back to the team, or is this another form of Red Bull's heartless mindset? Aren't the winning constructor trophies awarded on the podium for this exact reason? I can understand Hamilton giving trophies to his team because he has them coming out of his ears, but this was Checo's second ever win in a decade and the greatest achievement of his career. He described giving the trophy back as giving away one of his children. Thanks, Charlie. So the trophy thing is different all over the place, but there are some common threads. So, for instance, there are some tracks like Silverstone where the trophy that's handed out isn't really a trophy. It's sort of like the club trophy. It's one that is only ever handed out ceremonially and then given back right away. It's not owned by the drivers. It's owned by the club.
I think Indianapolis the Indy 500 is that way too, where you get your face etched on it or something.
Right. Exactly.
And there's one trophy and it has all these drivers on it, right?
Yeah. So exactly. It's not like, for instance, but oftentimes they will hold on to that as opposed to say, you know, the World Cup or, you know, the European Cup where the team has it for the years that it won or whatever.
Stanley Cup.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. The ever-growing Stanley Cup, perhaps the best example of how silly and brilliant a rule that is. But there are some teams, for instance, who always keep their trophies for the team. McLaren is probably one of the more obvious ones of this. I think Red Bull also do this, and I think maybe Ferrari do as well, where the idea is that the driver did not win the race, the team won the race. So the team retains the trophy, and they will also often get the replicas that are made given to the driver. So the actual trophy that is handed out, if it is handed out, is kept by the team. So McLaren are always pretty dogmatic about this. They have a pretty impressive trophy set. I believe during Lewis's entire career there, he didn't get to keep any of his trophies. I think now he has a clause where he does at Mercedes.
Amazing.
The only other notable exception I remember is David Coulthard got to keep one after he survived that plane crash. I forget which,
right.
Yeah, there was some race. I forget which race it was, but it was when he was at McLaren that he ended up, they allowed him to keep it as a special instance. But yes, it is common for the trophies either to be ceremonial in nature at some tracks, or more often than not, the trophies are held by the team, depending on the team, and then drivers get replicas. But it does change. It changes driver, team, track. There's no one sort of cut and dry explanation to it. I'm sure we'll get some emails about specific instances from people. So if you have any of those stories, send them in, shiftf1podcast@gmail.com.
I'd be in favor of like, all right, it gets sent to the team. The team gets it for a little while. And then like, you know, after a few years, then the driver gets it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I bet there's one of those too. I bet there's one where after a while, they get to hold on to it. Especially if you're like, especially this era and you're not Lewis. Like, how important is a win? You know, it's pretty good. They're pretty good now. You know, they're worth their weight in whatever it is, aluminium.
Well, shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or f1.cool/emails. You can send in questions or answers to Danny's questions. You can also hit us up on Twitter at shiftf1podcast. I'm at Drew Scanlon. That is at Danny O'Dwyer. And Rob Zachney is at Rob Zachney. That's us around the internet. Should we take it around the world, Danny?
Let's race around the world. This big, beautiful globe, yeah.
Kicking it off on Friday with Camping World Truck at the Nashville Super Speedway for the Rackley Roofing 200.
Best roofing in the game.
Followed by the kickoff, I believe, of the DTM season.
Oh, get yourself ready physically for the DTM.
So DTM at
so Monza. Do some stretches.
Limber up. Formula 3 will be supporting Formula 1 at Paul Ricard this weekend. So we've got two races there.
Awesome.
Formula E is in what country? Is this Mexico? This weekend for, I also think, two E-Prix.
Oh.
The NASCAR Xfinity Series is also in Nashville for the Tennessee Lottery 250. Supercars are at the Hidden Valley racetrack.
Where is it? Don't tell us. Don't tell us, Drew. We're not meant to know.
It's on top of your salad. For the Darwin Triple Crown. MotoGP is at the Sachsenring.
Excuse me?
In Germany for the Liquimolli Motorrad Grand Prix Deutschland.
Love that Liquimolli. Every time I go out clubbing on that Liquimolli.
Boy, there's a lot this weekend. We have Moto. I just said that one. IndyCar is at Road America for the Rev Group Grand Prix.
Cool.
Yes. And we've got Super Formula at Sportsland Sugo, which is in
Sportsland.
It is in Sugo Murata Shibata District, Miyagi Prefecture.
Terrific.
Japan. And we got NASCAR. Don't think we don't, because we got the trucks and the Xfinity cars.
Where the trucks also, go, we go.
Exactly. We're also at NASCAR for the Ally 400. Yep.
I'm with you on the E-Prix. It took me a while to parse out this weekend's E-Prix. It is the 2021 CBMM Niobium Puebla E-Prix.
Niobium? Isn't that what they're looking for in Avatar?
Like, you're not too far off. It is a light gray crystalline and ductile transition metal, which I guess is harvested by the good people at... Well, I don't know if they're good people. They extract things from the earth, so maybe they're not. CBMM, who makes stuff in cars, and Puebla is a town outside of Mexico City. So there you go.
Okay.
We did it.
There you go.
We solved the riddle.
Live on this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we've also got Formula One. What do you know? Friday, June 18th, Free Practice 1 kicks off on ESPN2 at 5:30 a.m. Eastern Time, followed by Free Practice 2. Did I say Free Practice 1 or whatever? Free Practice 1 is at 5:30 on ESPN2. Free Practice 2 is at 9 a.m. on ESPNU.
Ooh.
Saturday, June 19th, is Free Practice 3 at 6 a.m. Eastern Time on ESPN2, followed by qualifying at 9 a.m. also on ESPN2. And the Sunday race, everybody, June 20th, 9 a.m. on ESPN.
That's a reasonable time.
It is. That'll be 6 a.m. for you and I.
Oh, right.
That's watchable.
Yeah, and if it's not, hey, if it's a stinker... There's lots of other races on this weekend. Don't worry about it.
Go
check
to
out
sleep.
Some E-Prix. The Formula 3 stuff will be good too, I bet. It's like Formula 1, except the cars are slower and there's twice as many of them. How bad can that go?
And they're going to be very close together because they are very similar.
Yes, it's good stuff.
Indeed. Final thoughts, Danny, ahead of Paul Ricard.
Cautiously pessimistic, is that a thing? I'm not quite sure.
Sure.
Hoping for the best. I'm going in with low expectations, Drew.
There you go.
Because if that happens, then no matter what happens, it'll be a good time.
Well, yes, looking forward to it. Fingers crossed. If you would like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes, you can do so over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.